The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning, and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're so glad you could join our virtual circle this morning. There's a space for you and any neighbor or friend you'd like to invite to join with us this Sunday or any other Sunday in the future. We are a welcoming congregation, and we welcome you, whomever you love, whatever your gender or gender expression, wherever you are on your life journey or your spiritual journey. We welcome you into this ever-growing circle of love and compassion and justice. I'm the Reverend Larry Pierce. I'm minister at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and I'm so glad you were able to join us this morning. If you happen to be joining us for the very first time, a very special welcome. And if you happen to be attending for the last few times as well, and have not yet signed our Connect card, which will appear in the chat, then please take a moment, click on that card, give us your name, your email address, and tell us what you'd like to know or receive from us. And we would love to connect with you following this service and have an opportunity to chat with you as well whenever you would like. So, let's begin our service with these opening words, which I've chosen from the Buddhist teacher, Tara Brach. And these are from her book, Radical Acceptance, and they give a focus to our theme for today, which is creating a sacred pause. She writes, "The sacred pause helps us reconnect with the present moment, especially when we are caught up in striving and obsessing and leaning into the future. Pausing enables us to re-enter the mystery and vitality only found in the here and the now." So we will be exploring more of that topic today. And now I'll turn to Sherry, who will light our chalice.
Our chalice lighting words this morning are written by Reverend Naomi King. As we nurture this precious light together, we become a light of hope, turning isolation into community, anguish into peace, sorrow into joy. Nurture this precious light. As we do, our faith burns a steady flame of innovation, banishing illusion, creating a new and renewing way together. Together, we may turn this world from bleak to bright. Our peace lamp will be lit by Preston Lutweiler.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, "And with all the people of the world." May peace be with us and with all the people of the world.
So I want to introduce our gathering song, the words of which will appear on the screen momentarily. Particularly because I want to point out that this is a Transylvanian hymn tune. Now, most of us associate Transylvania with Dracula. However, many of us should also know that there is a very vital presence of Unitarians in Transylvania, and there is a long history and legacy of Unitarian villages and churches in the country now that includes, of course, Romania. Most of the Transylvanians are Hungarian by background, but I've had the opportunity to visit many of those villages and many of those Unitarians in Transylvania. And so this hymn, which is a traditional Transylvanian hymn tune, has new words that have been provided by Carl Seberg, a Unitarian minister in this country. So let's sing together, Find a Stillness.
Find a stillness, hold a stillness, let the stillness carry me. Find the silence, hold the silence, let the silence carry me. In the Spirit, by the Spirit,
song. So how many of you knew there was a vital presence of Unitarians in Transylvania? Raise your hand. Okay, great. Okay, wonderful. Okay, good. So I want to actually talk about something else today, and that is because we're in this month of Ramadan, I want to focus on a particular practice among the mystical group within Islam called the Sufis, which probably many of you have heard. And of course, the most well-known Sufi in America is Rumi. And so we're going to watch in just a moment a short video of a practice called Sima, which is Sufi dancing, dancing by whirling dervishes. And I've had an opportunity to actually see a group of whirling dervishes perform live. Has anyone else seen that? Anyone else been able to do that? Yeah, they're sometimes they travel around the country. And I remember one of my family members that was with us when we went to this theater to see it, she called them Sufis. So maybe she has the correct pronunciation, but I'm going to say Sufis. So as we watch this short video, which is a few minutes, I want us to recognize that this dance is actually a spiritual practice. And there are some things within this that are practices that are laden with symbolic meaning, and I want to point those out to you. So the melodious reed flute represents the divine breath that gives life to everything. The dervish with, in this case, men, his headdress symbolizes his ego's tombstone, and the white skirt, his ego's shroud. So there's a way in which this dance represents letting go of ego in order to enter into this other sacred kind of space within the dance itself. And then you'll notice that the dervishes will remove their black cloak. And this represents a spirituality that is born to truth and is ready to journey towards that truth. So at each stop in the Sima, each stop in the Sufi dance, the dervish holds his or her own arms crosswise this way to kind of testify to a sense of oneness or a felt sense of unity or oneness. And The dervishes are believed actually to be kind of a conduit for divine blessings. So you'll notice another movement while whirling with their arms wide open. Usually their right hand is directed to the skies and their left hand is turned towards the earth. And this represents taking that, being that kind of conduit of divine energy towards the earth. So as we review this short clip of Sufi or whirling dervishes, what I'd like us to do is to listen to this and to watch this with our hearts and not our minds. Let's enter into that place of knowing that is represented by the knowledge of our heart. And as you watch this, I want you to think about what's a movement that that would represent for you a prayer that you have for yourself this day. What movement would you do? So, and if I had the chance to reflect on it, and I did, ahead of asking the question, my movement would be like this, to represent embracing this moment, to represent embracing each of you that are here today and my longing for that connection with you. So that would be my movement. So as you reflect on this dance, think about what your own movement would be. And if you feel so inspired, you can actually do that movement during this dance. So let's watch this with our hearts.
Akarsuyun gidişine yüzerseniz daha rahat olur. Ama terse yüzerseniz çok daha zor olur, yorulursunuz. Bu da aynı. Dünya dönüyor, sen de dönüyor. Bütün zerreler dönüyor, sen de dönüyorsun orada. Şimdi bizim dünya görüşünü Yaradan'ı kendi vücudunda hisseden bir görüşe sahiptir. 20 senedir semazenlik yapıyorum. Ben 66 yaşındayım. İşte bir tarikat bir yerine gittiğimde orada Sufizm uygulaması öğrenmeye başladım. Mana temizlik. Dünyadan soyunuyorsun siyah hırkayı çıkarttığın zaman. Dünyevi şeylerden. Şimdi ilk sola attığın zaman al deriz. Bunu attığımız zaman da lah deriz. Allah, Allah, Allah. Ama bu zikir içtendir. Sağ el üsttedir. Sol el onun altındadır. Yani haktan alır, halka dağıtırım. Valla orada da bir yakınlık hissediyorsunuz. Yaradan'dan bir yakınlık hissediyorsunuz. Yaradan her şahsın şah damarından daha yakındır. Dönmede dünya dönüyor. Her tüm zerreler dönüyor.
Okay, I'm looking at all of us in the gallery view right now, and I'm wondering if you have a movement or a posture that represents for you a prayer. If you'll do that right now, I'll do mine again, and I'll look and see if anyone else has one. So we'll see what those are, but hold it up so we can see it. Don't, if you can. Okay, great. So let's embrace those prayers, which become more than a prayer of words, but become a way of being in the world. So maybe. So now I want to have us move into a time of meditation, which will include some Sufi music, Sufi meditation music. And I want to lead us into this meditation by giving you a couple questions to ponder. Now, I'm going to give you two questions. You can choose one or the other question, or you can do both. I know the overachievers among us want to try to fit in both. So I'll give you two that gives you some options. But try to listen to this music again by going inside and listening with your mind as well as your heart as you try to respond to either or both of these questions. So as we're listening to the music, I want you to listen to your thoughts as well as your intuitions, to your emotions as well as your sensations. And the questions are these. The first question is, how is it with your soul? The second question is, what makes your heart sing or dance? So as we listen to the music, you can focus on one of those questions or both of them. So let's move into this musical meditation reflecting on the questions. So if you came to a crossroads and there were two signs, and one sign read, this way to life, and the other sign read, this way to God, which way would you choose? How many generations of honest people have been bewildered by this apparent dilemma, believing that the way to God lies in the opposite direction from a human life? How many people's psycho-spiritual health has been undermined because they took the road away from life, away from their own humanity? These words are by one of my favorite contemporary Sufi writers, Kabir Helminski. And what I've really appreciated about the Sufi path is this understanding that spirituality is to be infused within life. That the spiritual is not a separate dimension of life where we take occasional vacations every now and then, but and that we know in our heart of hearts that life isn't always these either-or dilemmas that appear as clearly as on those signs that Helminski refers to. Yet, don't we often fall for this kind of understanding that God's this way and life this way as a seeming dilemma? Don't we fall for other ones like this? Like sometimes we imagine we have to choose between mind or heart, reason or intuition, accomplishment or meaning. What a lopsided approach to life this would be if we thought we had to choose among these things. Although some in our culture and also some in our rationally oriented religions seem to pressure us to make a choice, to divide ourselves into these parts of ourselves rather than recognize that each part of ourself is a portal to a way of knowing and being in the world. This week, I found a phrase from Paolo Ferrucci, the Italian author and psychotherapist, that actually helps us to convey this synthesis between these dimensions of ourselves rather than some seeming antithesis or opposites. His phrase is, as well as. So let's try that on. Rather than say mind or heart, we could say mind as well as heart. Rather than say reason or intuition, we could say reason as well as intuition, accomplishment as well as meaning. Now, in my view, this is not just semantics or play on words. I feel it's essential for us to claim the whole enchilada of our human experience and not pretend that we're divided into these parts. Furthermore, given the wounds of our fragile earth, given the tragic dis-ease and legacy of racism and of violence, which we are so painfully aware of this week, we need to bring our whole selves to these religious and human tasks that lie before us. To respond to these concerns, these tasks, we need to think as well as feel. We need to reason as well as imagine our way through them. We need to inhabit more of ourselves, more of life as it is. Yes, these are for me religious tasks requiring our utmost devotion and practicality. This is Helminski's point. I've put it this way, we need to live a spirituality-infused life, whether we show up with our Sunday go-to-meeting self every darn moment of the day or not, we need to aim ourselves towards this, not just at special times or moments. That's our challenge. I don't always get there, but fortunately, we have teachers and guides and religious communities and experiences that help hone our capacities of living a life that's grounded, centered, open, alive, and aware along the way. Now, I've been particularly drawn to this Sufi understanding of a unitive consciousness and an integral way of being in the world for a long time. Not that I can sustain this awareness, but I know when I've drifted. As a matter of fact, as an undergraduate psychology student, so now we're talking about Stone Age times, okay? I was fascinated by Robert Orenstein's book, The Psychology of Consciousness, and I got to hear him in some lectures when he was a guest at the college. In the book and in his lecture, Orenstein often told Sufi tales. And I learned later that this Stanford University psychologist actually had worked with a modern Sufi teacher, Idris Shah, in the 1960s. And this is how he became acquainted and fascinated by Shah's rich collection of Sufi stories. They collaborated together in the areas of consciousness and human knowledge and Sufism's contributions to a human psychology. Orenstein found in these stories teaching examples of how the linear or the rational and the nonlinear, the intuitive functions of the brain are actually connected. And in recent years, we know a lot more about these kind of connections in our brain than we knew back in the 70s, when I was in college, late 70s. We know that there are questions that cannot be answered without taking an inventory of our own heart, as well as our mind, our living, as well as our interacting with life. Such questions like those that I asked during the meditation, how is it with your soul, or what makes your heart sing or dance, can only fully be answered from that place where our heart and our mind intersect, where reason and intuition can be heard and actually listened to. Pausing with questions like this, I believe, help us, in the words of the Unitarian minister, A. Powell Davies, to grow a soul. Sufi stories bring us to this insightful place of connection, sometimes in delightful ways. So I want to tell this story by the great 13th century storyteller Rumi, probably the best known and best-selling Sufi teacher in America. So Rumi told this story. A grammar teacher fell in the well and was screaming for help. A dervish came along. He said, "I'll get you out. I seen a ladder up at the mosque." The grammarian, remember, who was in the well, said, "Young man, your verb tense is incorrect." The dervish said, "If that's what you think is important in this situation, you'd better stay in the well until I learn to speak correctly." And then he went down the road. Such stories are funny, but they're also incisive in that they help us see ourselves. How easily do we, like the grammarian in this story, lose sight of the big picture of what's important in life? And in this case, the grammarian couldn't get outside of his accustomed role and habits to see that his life depended upon it. Being right was more important to the grammarian than being rescued. The story reminds me of one of Rumi's poems. Perhaps many of you have heard it before. The poem is called A Great Wagon, and I'll share just a few verses from it. The first verse is probably the one that's most known. "Out beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep." Some, like the grammarian in the story, are so possessed by being right that they cannot find that field beyond wrongdoing or rightdoing. In fact, Rumi's line, "Don't go back to sleep," is essential to Sufism and many other religious traditions, including Buddhism, which I'll be talking about later. So it's a wake-up call for sure when our hearts can get so hardened or so embittered that we can't be awake enough to see what's really going on, what's necessary, what's essential, and what's needed. It's a wake-up call for sure when this moment that we are in right now requires of us a wakefulness like never before in human history. The transformation of consciousness, living a divine infused life, only makes sense to the Sufi if the qualities of kindness, of compassion, and of understanding radiate from the portal of our heart to our interactions with others. As one Sufi teacher reminds us, "Don't be a thorn, become a rose." Don't be a thorn, become a rose. What a wonderful reminder. A wonderful way to pause now and then, particularly in those difficult interactions that sometimes arise. We can ask ourselves, am I being more like that thorn in the side, more like that thorn that's adding pain? Or am I being more like that rose that can share beauty and the kindness and the healing of compassion and understanding? So as years have gone by, past my college years now, one of the seminaries where I now teach is an interfaith seminary that has a long tradition of including Muslim students because they have programs in Muslim studies and a program for Muslim chaplains. So my students include Christians and Jews and Muslims. And this experience has really led me to appreciate an interreligious spirituality. It's also helped me to recover and to appreciate that in our own Unitarian history, that Unitarianism itself was inherently multi-religious. The Unitarian Universalist historian Susan Ritchie in her book, Children of the Same God, demonstrates how Unitarians in Eastern Europe claimed a strong affinity with Jews and Muslims from the very beginning, and how mutual theological underpinnings and active cooperation underpin Unitarian history. Though we've often forgotten that in this part of the world, in the United States, and our own telling of Unitarian Universalist history. So in my teaching, my life, and my preaching, I often seek to find resonant themes within and across religious faiths that can help us understand and connect with one another. One of those resonant themes is pauses, what I'm going to call sacred pauses, because it is a universal human need to pause, because becoming human requires taking reflective and restorative pauses. We need many reminders of this, to pause, to take sacred pauses. And so in many religious traditions, there are specified periods of time to take as a sacred pause, to take a time to step out of our usual routines, to be able to tend to our own processes of becoming, to deliberately create an inner and a collective space and times for reflection and reconnection to the sources of our spiritual renewal and to the possibilities of reconciliation. So let's look at these sacred pauses. The first one I'll review will be those in religious traditions that are scheduled periods of time. And then I'll remind us of some of the daily practices that are inherent in some religions around pauses during the day. And then I'll reflect with you on sacred pauses that can happen in unplanned and unexpected ways, but pauses that might be very necessary for our own health, our own well-being, our own spiritual connection, and our own capacity to relate with each other in a way of compassion. So let's look at these planned scheduled periods of pause. Most of you know these, the planned scheduled sacred pause periods across all religious traditions, particularly in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. For example, right now, our Muslim neighbors around the world are taking a sacred pause of sorts during this month of Ramadan, which will last until around May 11th. As you know, devout Muslims fast from dawn to dusk during this period, and they engage in special times of prayer during this month. Ramadan is also a period to deepen one's relationship with God, as well as to seek forgiveness and reconciliation with others. In other words, the signs of Ramadan point in both directions, this way to God and this way to human life. And the expectation is that Muslims will take both paths during this sacred pause, this month of Ramadan. After the daily fast, families come together to break the fast. And in recent years, it's also included times for interfaith fellowship. In fact, I gathered with some other faculty and staff from Hartford Seminary this week by Zoom as a way to break the fast from Ramadan on that day. As you know, in Judaism, there are also these planned periods of time that provide a sacred pause. Some are periods of times in which Jews set aside weeks or days for inner reflection and renewal. Jews right now are also in a period of scheduled sacred pauses. This is a period of the counting of the Omer, the days between the second day of Passover and the days before the holiday of Shavuot, the 50th day, which commemorates the giving of the Torah to Moses at Mount Sinai. Over this period, days of counting the Omer Jews may choose to take a pause at the end of each of those days, 49 days before going to sleep. And each daily pause can be a time, as one Jewish writer describes, for reviewing your day, seeing where you've succeeded or achieved, produced or laughed or shared or gave or received, and to see where you could have done better, been nicer or kinder, who you may have hurt and who hurt you, and to ask for forgiveness and to offer forgiveness. Certainly this kind of practice over a sustained time is most certainly portable to any of us, whatever our religious tradition or backgrounds, who want to focus on what our lives are and what we want our lives to become. This kind of tending of the soul, the tending of our lives, is so essential to our religious lives, our wanting to be human religiously. And of course, there are other extended periods of planned sacred pauses in Judaism. We know about Hanukkah, Passover, the high holy days, that can also have deeper psycho-spiritual purposes as well as religious ones. One of my teachers, Joel Ziff, who's a psychotherapist, who's also Jewish, has called these holidays mirrors in time. He writes, they offer sanctuaries in time, safe havens in which we have support and encouragement to confront challenges. We stop normal daily activity. We locate ourselves in the changes of the seasons. He continues, holy days become mirrors for seeing ourselves in a new light as we journey through the year. And as we do so, we can better manifest the potential of who we may be, healing ourselves, our community, and our planet. Scheduled periods of sacred pauses exist for Christians as well, and most of us know about the period of Lent of 40 days that has traditionally included a time of fasting, self-reflection, attending to reconciliation of one's life to God and to others. So I think it's a really good idea to have these planned and expected pauses built into a religious tradition because they can be shared experiences and not just individual ones. There can be a tacit recognition that as a religious community, we're calling a halt to business as usual so that at least some sliver of our attention turns inward and outward. There's another practice within both Judaism and Islam and Christianity that are daily pauses, pauses that happen during a particular day. So once when I was teaching a group of modern Orthodox rabbis, I had to work my teaching schedule around their daily prayer schedule of praying three times a day. At those times, the rabbis would scatter around the grounds or the room that we were meeting in and with their siddur and to pray individually. And then we would come back and regather. Everything else would stop during these sacred pauses. When I've taught or attended retreats in Christian monasteries, there's also been these sacred pauses called praying the hours that occur during the day. Macrina Weidercker, a contemporary author, has written a book entitled Seven Sacred Pauses, Living Mindfully Through the Hours of the Day. And in this, she finds some contemporary and some enduring meaning for this ancient practice of praying the hours, not just for the monk, but for all of us. She offers these verses early on in her book. Reverence each hour as a small stepping stone on your pilgrimage through the day. Receive the gift of seven sacred pauses. Practice waking up seven times a day. Now, for most of us, I'm assuming that the idea of pausing just a few times a day to practice waking up or to take sacred pauses as a routine might really be a stretch of the imagination, certainly a stretch out of our usual habits of being entrained to move from one activity to another, to keep going, and to not take regular rest stops, to ask, how's it going and where we are going, could be essential processes of growing our soul each day. The Buddhist teacher, as I mentioned earlier, Tara Brach, encourages us to take pauses during an activity that we may be engrossed in. And so, since I know that you are all so engrossed in my sermon right now, I'm just double checking by looking at you on the screen, I'm going to invite us to follow her instructions now. So, let's take a few breaths. Let's allow our eyes to close if that's comfortable for you. Let go of any worries or thoughts about what you are going to do next. Let go of any tightness in your body. Now notice, what are you experiencing as you inhabit this pause? What sensations do you feel? What pulls do you feel to kind of move beyond this, to move on to the next thing? Can you, just for another moment, simply allow for this moment, whatever it is, to happen in you as it's occurring? In those traditions where there are these regular practices, whether it's Buddhist mindfulness practice or Jewish prayer, or the Christians who pray the hours, for any of us who just pick pauses in our day, have often found that these pauses routinely through our day allow us to carry some qualities of mindfulness, awakeness, and compassion into our daily activities. Now there's a whole other category beyond these structured periods of sacred pauses around these daily routine pauses, and it's what I call the unexpected but necessary pauses in everyday life. This is where we need to buckle our seatbelts. So even if you can't imagine moving through your day with creating some specific kind of pauses like we just did, there's still multiple other opportunities for a pause, a sacred pause. They're always present. Sometimes they elude us, sometimes we avoid them, yet those opportunities are always there to call a halt to what's going on in order to reset, to reconnect, and to renew. In the recovery community, the word HALT is kind of an acronym that stands for an awareness of the physiological and psychological states that are often high risk and can make one susceptible to possible relapse behaviors. These states include H for hungry, A for angry, L for lonely, T for tired. The point for any of us is to be self-aware enough to recognize when we are in one of these states and how they can manifest themselves. And if we can put an early stop to that domino trigger effect that can happen when we're there, we can prevent relapse, or we can cause, or we can prevent the possibility of our own tiredness or loneliness or hunger spilling over in ways that we might later regret. There are other sacred pauses that are so necessary. And as I speak of these, I want you to imagine these sacred pauses as maybe being accompanied by a fire alarm or an emergency button, okay? Because oftentimes when we get heated up and hardly even recognize that we might need to pause, that's so necessary to pause in those moments. It's nice if we can recognize it in ourselves. Oftentimes we don't. It's nice if we can recognize it before our own internal sprinkler system goes off and spills over on everyone else, including ourselves. And another Buddhist, Pema Chodron, has been sort of an excellent contemporary teacher on this phenomenon of activation, of being able to use these states where we get triggered to recalibrate in the moment and to learn from them. These moments are sometimes called shempas or kleshas in the Buddhist literature, but an alternative tradition translation might be hooked, to get hooked. Pema Chodron writes, here's how a shempa shows up in everyday experiences. Somebody says a harsh word and something in you tightens instantly. You're hooked. That tightness quickly spirals into blaming the person or denigrating yourself. And the chain reaction of speaking or acting or obsessing happens so fast, you hardly even know it. You're in it before you even know it. Maybe you have strong addictions, or you go right for your addiction in that moment, even if that addiction is an addiction to being right. You seek to cover over the uncomfortable feelings by avoiding them. This is very personal. What was said gets to you. It triggers you. It might not bother someone else at all, but we're talking about what touches your sore place, that sore place of what's called shempa, your own triggers, your own activating spots. As soon as the words have registered, boom, you're there. Shempa is not the thoughts, she says, or the emotions per se. Shempa is oftentimes pre-verbal, but it reads thoughts and emotions very quickly. It's important that she recognizes that it's pre-verbal because we want to be able to, in her teaching, be able to recognize that state before it gets to words, before it heats up in a whole slew of emotions. So if we catch it when it first arises, then that's the point of children's thinking. Now, of course, she's not talking about real injustices or harms that are being done to people. She's referring to those everyday triggers that are peculiar to us in our interactions. Anybody kind of recognize that now, I'm gonna raise my hand first, that there are these times when you get triggered or activated, you get into it before you even realize it, okay? Maybe even bringing it up, you're beginning to feel it. Okay, let's calm ourselves down now. Take a breath. Okay, so one Buddhist teacher pointed out that in the West, we often have what he calls bourgeois suffering. These can be including things like traffic jams, like being in a traffic jam. We get heated up, we have a whole story, and we get into a whole state of mind emotionally and so forth. Or we ask for an aisle seat and they give us a middle seat, or our eggs that we ordered are not scrambled enough, or a comma is misplaced. These are like the bourgeois suffering. But the fact of the matter is that when we're experiencing it, we get caught up in it even before we know it sometimes. So Chodron says, train yourself on these. When they happen, take a sacred pause, maybe even follow the direction from Tara Brach to like take a breath in that moment. Take a breath in that moment. Pema Chodron, in her trainings, invites her students to keep a journal for a time to recognize their experiences of these as they arise during the day. These are sacred pauses, opportunities for growth and change and becoming alive and awake. Note, what are the triggers? How does it feel in your body? How conscious are you beforehand, during, or afterwards? And I've done this, and over time, you do develop that capacity to notice just as it's beginning to arise before you slide right into it, like on slippery ice. Over time, one can take a sacred pause and just notice your own responses to what occurs. Often how we get hooked is disproportionate to what actually occurred. We add the heat to the situation. We are activated, and then we become obsessed and possessed by our reactions. When we come to observe these responses, however, we can gradually come to a place where we can manage our irritations differently, not just because what they do to others, but just as importantly, what they do to us. Most important part of Chodron's teaching, in my opinion, is, I believe, her recognition of how attached we can become to our own storyline about these events when they're occurring. We get hooked. the more attached we are to our own storyline about what the other person did, why they're doing it, how they're doing it, what they should do, what should be happening, the more attached we come to that storyline, the more heated up we become, the more possessed we can become with our own emotions, the harder it is to disentangle. So this is a very practical piece of advice. Take notes on this one. She advises us to simply drop the story. Between the event that activated and our own reaction, our own activation, usually there's a story in between. She says, drop that story. And notice how when we drop the story, that our stirred up emotions and our fixated thoughts can also shift as well. Drop the story. Let's just all say that together. Drop the story. Say it a little louder. Drop the story. Let's have that be like a reminder as we go through this week to really notice that even if the story has a sliver of truth, even if we have like an encyclopedia volumes of the story, it's typically not the whole truth, just the case we're trying to make to ourselves or to others. So this realization of what story we are telling ourselves can be a sacred pause. It can be a moment of being awake. Chodron writes, we have the capacity to wake up and to live consciously, but you may have noticed we also have a strong inclination to stay asleep. It's as if we're always at a crossroads, she says, continually choosing which way to go. Moment by moment, we can choose to go forward with further clarity and happiness or towards confusion and pain. And so in conclusion, I want to say in the times in which we live, given all that is worthy of our utmost aliveness, attention, and devotion, there's a question that we can ask ourselves as we face the problems of our world, the deep concerns of everything that's happening around us, as we face our own troubles and our own concerns. We face a different crossroad moment in everyday life. And we can ask ourselves this question. Are we living in a way that adds further aggression and self-centeredness to the mix? Or are we adding some much needed sanity, compassion, and equanimity? So may this be a week in which we take some unexpected pauses that life presents to us. May we learn to practice this, not just for the sake of ourselves, but for all of our relations and for the sake of the world that needs us to be more centered and to be less activated in ways that don't add something constructive. So may it be. Amen. So this is a time in our service where we do take a pause and we reflect on our own lives and the life of our world. And we ask ourselves, what is a joy or a celebration that I'm experiencing this week? Or what is a concern that I am holding for myself, those I love, or this world? And we try to be with that experience of a joy or a concern as we play the interlude music. And then if you choose to share that with us, you have two options. One is you can use the raised hand function and one of the moderators will call on you, or you can write something in the chat, okay? Let's remember to be brief so that we allow time and space for anyone who wants to share to have time to do it, but also to honor the parameters of our service. So let's listen to the music and then we'll get further instructions from the moderator. Thank you.
I now invite you to sing with me, Spirit of Life.
Please join me in reading the closing words by Theodore Parker. The words are on your screen. Be our is a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living.
So our closing song is My Life Flows On, an endless song. I hope you will sing it. I know you will sing it actually as beautifully as Enya sang it as we did our prelude this morning. So here we go. Join in when you're ready. And let's sing. This is our closing song.
Rejoice both far and near. How can I